from the car's open window. The suicide bomber was sitting in the lane in the white opal, completely surrounded. That's what Abu Salim could see from his window in the wooden mashrabiya balcony. He should go downstairs to warn the rest of the family to get out of the house, or at least move into one of the back rooms. The house was bound to collapse if the suicide bomber blew himself up. But Abu Salim didn't do anything. He had woken up from his doze to the sound of megaphones ordering the suicide bomber to get out of the car with his hands up. He had gone up one floor, looked out the window, and was surprised to see the car right under his balcony. But he still saw no need to act. He didn't even notice he was barefoot. In the meantime, Abu Anmar had managed to leave the area in his new truck before they imposed the security cordon. Faraj, the real estate agent, had come out of his house and stood looking across the street at the hotel he had just bought. He was planning to go to the bakery just down the lane to buy bread and a bowl of clotted cream when the bomb went off. 2. Hadi saw the dark wooden panel of the Jewish carving fly through the air, and the wooden candelabra break loose from it and shatter. Or maybe he imagined it during his long hospital stay. Everything in his house was thrown into chaos in the fraction of a second it took for the full force of the explosion to strike. Not only was the driver wearing a suicide belt, but the car itself was also rigged with explosives. The explosion rocked the whole neighborhood. Cracks would later be found in the Liberty Monument. But the most serious impact was on the old houses in Lane 7, some of which had been built in the 1930s. Elishva's house collapsed. So did Hadi's. Elishva's things and some other wooden furniture caught fire in Hadi's courtyard, and the fire spread to Hadi's bed. The fact that Hadi had survived was seen as a miracle, reminding everyone of the lies he had been telling for years about how he had survived falling down mountains and flying through the air after explosions. He had indeed defied death this time. The blast threw Faraj many feet in the air, resulting in a serious injury and some bruising on his face. The facade of Salim's house was destroyed, while the walls inside were cracked. Fortunately, most of the family was asleep inside and survived. As for Abu Salim, he crashed to the ground with his balcony, suffering leg and arm fractures and wounds and scratches, but he didn't die. He was taken to the nearby Kindi hospital, where he raved at the journalists who came to take pictures of the injured and to listen to their accounts of the incident. He was like a broken record, going on and on about everything he had seen from his balcony over the years— the people coming and going at the six houses within his view, the whores who went in and out of the printing press next to Elishva's house, the thieves who climbed over the walls. A week later, he had a special visitor, a well-dressed man in his 40s, with a digital recorder, who sat on the chair nearby, greeted him in a friendly manner, and asked him to speak. Abu Salim asked him who he was, and he said, "I'm the writer."
"Writer of what?"
"I write short stories."
"What would you like me to tell you?"
"Tell me everything." 3. The senior astrologer saw from behind the partially open window of the four-wheel drive how Brigadier Majid got past the guards who had closed off Lane 7. This made him anxious. He opened the door and got out, his long, thick beard swinging from side to side as he hurried along. When he reached the guards, he called out to the brigadier.
"What are you doing, sir? Do you want to die?"
"I have to arrest this criminal myself," said the brigadier.
"You'll be killed, sir. Come back, I implore you. Come on, let me read the cards."
He saw the senior astrologer crouch on the ground and then sit cross-legged, as he did in the offices of the tracking and pursuit department. He took a large pack of playing cards from his pocket and started shuffling them like a professional. Then he threw them on the pavement, set some of them aside, and removed others. He picked up one card and looked at it closely, as if he had discovered something. The brigadier crouched down next to him. The guards standing at the end of the street didn't know what was going on, but were intrigued and took their eyes off the suicide bomber's car for a few moments. The astrologer pulled out a new card, looked at it intently, and said,
The one who has no name is not in the house.
What do you mean? So why did you bring us here?
Where is he?
He was here until a quarter of an hour ago. He went over the roofs. I don't know exactly where he went. Maybe he hasn't left Badawin yet. But he has left the house, that's for sure.
But I want to be certain, said the brigadier.
He stood up and turned toward the lane and the white opal.
It will cost you your life, said the old astrologer,
quickly gathering his cards and putting them back in the pocket of his long gown.
There's something else, said the astrologer,
expecting Brigadier Majid to turn toward him.
This car bomb, in a way, we're responsible for it.
The brigadier turned round at that and walked up to the old astrologer.
How so?
He asked.
We have to go back to the department immediately. It's one of my assistants, the junior astrologer. He moved the car to this place with the intention of killing the criminal who has no name, but now the criminal has escaped, and the suicide bomber doesn't know why he was sent here.
What do you mean? What kind of nonsense is that?
We must go back now,
the astrologer insisted, walking back toward the four-wheel drive. Then the car bomb exploded. Brigadier Majid and the astrologer were engulfed in a thick cloud of dust. They jumped into the car and went back to the office, where the brigadier summoned his whole team and opened an inquiry into the incident. He discovered that the suicide bomber had originally intended to go to the police academy and blow himself up in the middle of a gathering of new officers. But something made him drive to the back streets of Badawin instead. The astrologers broke out into an uproar, ignoring the brigadier as they exchanged insults. Within an hour, the brigadier realized the inquiry he had opened wouldn't do any good. It might even put him and his department in the firing line from other branches of the government. So he closed it down and temporarily suspended the activities of the astrologers. 2 weeks later, a committee of senior officers in military and general intelligence came to question him in the presence of an American liaison officer. While he had been dreaming of being promoted to director of intelligence, he now found himself facing the possibility of early retirement. 4. Mahmud was asleep in his room when a powerful tremor in the distance shook the hotel. He opened his eyes for a few seconds, then went back to sleep. Around 8:30, he heard about the horrific incident from a young man who worked at the hotel.
There's now water from damaged sewage and drinking water pipes spilling into Sa'adun Street and the Bab al-Sharqi Tunnel. They say dozens of houses have been flattened. There's a crater in the middle of Lane 7, a huge crater, and some people say they saw a stone wall at the bottom of it.
Mahmud thought of the Oruba Hotel, which was near the site of the explosion. Maybe something had happened to his photographer friend, Hazem Aboud, or to Abu Anmar, and others he knew in the area. He called Hazem, who told him he was not in Baghdad, but was embedded with the U.S. Army, taking pictures of combat operations for an American news agency. He said Abu Anmar had left Baghdad, having sold the hotel and gone back to his family in Qalat Sukar. This came as a surprise to Mahmud, but it was a relief that no one he knew had died, he told himself, and went out into the street and hailed a taxi to the office. On the short trip, he ran through the situation at the magazine. The deadline for the next edition was fast approaching. He hadn't paid the salaries of some of the staff. Saidi hadn't sent him anything. The accountant with the grim face hadn't answered Mahmud's calls in 2 days. Saidi had to come back to relieve him of this anxiety. When he saw him, he would tell him he wanted to go back to his old job as just a sub-editor. When he reached the offices, he saw some government vehicles parked in the lane. Maybe they were checking the National Bank of Iraq nearby. But when he went through the front door, which was wide open, he was sure they had come to see him. Armed guards in plain clothes stopped him and asked for his identity card. When they found out he was the editor of the magazine, they let him in. The old janitor looked at him in bafflement, but didn't say anything, just continued to wipe the tables and move around as though it were an ordinary day. Everyone seemed to have fled the magazine, or else they knew something he didn't know and preferred not to be involved. When Mahmud went into Saidi's office, he saw 4 men with mustaches dressed in suits. They were about the same age as Saidi. When he introduced himself, they asked him to sit, then told him they were shutting down the magazine and confiscating all its assets.
"What's happened?" he asked.
Mahmood felt his stomach starting to twist. One of the men looked at him intently, raised a finger in his face and said,
"Your friend has stolen $13 million of U.S. aid money."
$13 million? How did he steal it? He's a well-known writer, a well-known person.
Ask him how. And now, give us the keys to this safe.
Mahmood gave them the key, and the strange men acted fast, confiscating everything. But Saidi never left any money at the magazine. They had turned the offices upside down, moving the furniture around, and even pulling up the carpet in the conference room, looking for places where Saidi might have hidden his stolen money.
How could Saidi do this? Has he really done this to me?
Mahmood asked himself. It all seemed like a big misunderstanding, and that these men would apologize, give him back the keys, and ask him to forgive them. The man with the biggest mustache, who seemed to be in charge of the group, came up to Mahmood.
Call your boss, and if he answers, give me the phone.
Mahmood hurriedly called Saidi, though he was well aware that there would be no answer. He called him again from another phone, but the result was the same.
The number is out of service, Mahmood said apologetically.
The man with the thick mustache looked at him in disbelief. Everything was over in 45 minutes. Abu Juni put his wet mop over his shoulder and just left the building, not even looking at Mahmood as he walked past. Mahmood didn't know what he was going to do. He had been waiting for his back salary to pay off his debts to the hotel. He called the accountant on his cell phone, and then his friends and colleagues at the magazine. Some numbers just kept ringing. Some people answered to say they were sorry but couldn't do anything. In the end, the man with the thick mustache turned to Mahmood, patted him on the shoulder and said,
"Let's go, my friend. You're coming with us for questioning."
Questioning?
Yes. Did you think it would be easy?
Mahmood got into one of their vehicles. He knew from the way Saidi joked with his friend Brigadier Majid that being questioned by the Iraqi security agencies would be physically painful, as Saidi described it. He was in shock. Everything had collapsed. He had lost his sense of self, and in order to save himself, he decided he wouldn't hide anything, because he was innocent.
$13 million!
He struggled to take it all in, as the government vehicle tore off down the road toward an unknown destination. 5. The interrogation of Brigadier Majid seemed endless. The panel, composed of Iraqi intelligence officers and liaison officers from the U.S. military police, decided to wait for more material evidence before making a formal accusation against the brigadier and his office. In the meantime, through his friends who were senior officers, the brigadier managed to postpone his interrogation and defer further humiliation for a while. He called in the senior astrologer, the junior astrologer, and the other low-level astrologers for a quick meeting. He had discovered that a secret struggle had been underway for some time among his staff, and was now rebounding on him personally, threatening to get him fired, and maybe put on trial.
"You're all fired," he told them,
and waited for their expressions of disbelief. But instead, they stood up and didn't say a word.
"Why don't you say something?"
he shouted at the senior astrologer.
"I already knew," he replied. "It's all because of my stupid assistant. He's my enemy, and he's destroyed me. This has nothing to do with you, sir. It's not your fault."
Brigadier Majid was puzzled. Of course they'd consulted their cards and mirrors and prayer beads made of beans before coming to the meeting, so they knew about his decision. But he had expected them to fight back, or ask for forgiveness, or say they would try to help him fix the situation, not just to abandon him. He didn't have it in him to go back on his decision. They would see him as weak. The department had collapsed from within, and now he was all on his own. The senior astrologer went back to his room. He calmly packed his bag, then went into the bathroom and rubbed his beard with soap and water to get rid of the hair gel. He took out a small pair of scissors, cut off half his beard, and trimmed it to suit the appearance of a religious man. That was to be his new image. He took off his flamboyant clothes and threw them into a large trash can in the bathroom, then put on a white cotton shirt with thin vertical blue stripes, dark cotton trousers, and summer shoes, He picked up his bag and was about to leave the department for his home in the Zafrania district, south of the capital, when he noticed fine grains of red sand on the floor, on his bed, and everywhere. He noticed the junior astrologer coming in, and he thought, what gall. He wanted to shout in his face, you've destroyed everything, you idiot! And maybe for a moment he thought of pouncing on him and strangling him with his aging hands. But that was no use now. He could keep an eye on him and do things to him by his own methods, even kill him on the spot, although he had never done that with anyone else. The junior astrologer was also changing his clothes, but he was putting on pajamas. He looked at his master, in his new guise, with a certain disdain, as if he wanted to remember this moment well. The moment when the senior astrologer fell off his perch and became just an ordinary person. They didn't exchange a word, only glances, and then the senior astrologer left the department, angry and bitter, throwing his small bag over his shoulder. Getting into a taxi, the senior astrologer told the old driver the address, and they agreed on a price. The astrologer tossed his bag into the back seat and stretched out in the front. He looked like a cleric disguised in civilian clothes. A few minutes later, he noticed they were driving down a street with no other cars and no pedestrians. The taxi slowed down, and the driver cleared his throat and said, I think I'm lost. The driver turned back the way he had come, but then discovered that the Americans had blocked the road. One of the soldiers was pointing a powerful flashlight at drivers and asking them to go down a side street. At the end of the street, the driver found he didn't know which direction to take. He pulled up against the curb and said, Forgive me, brother. My house is behind these buildings. Don't worry about the fare. Just get out here, please, and find yourself another taxi. This street is safe. The astrologer protested, but the driver refused to relent. Once the astrologer got out, the driver drove off in haste, leaving the astrologer waiting, with his bag, in the street for another taxi. After 2 minutes, the astrologer decided to head to a street with more traffic. He proceeded down a side street, then realized it was long and unlit. He knew, or thought he knew, what was going to happen that night, so he didn't see any reason to be frightened. Feeling exhausted, he remembered he hadn't had lunch, and now it was past dinner time. And apart from all that, he was a frail old man. Even his small bag seemed heavy. He continued down the dark side street, and through his round glasses, he could see the vague shape of a man standing in the middle of the street. The astrologer's throat was dry, so he swallowed some saliva, then stopped 2 yards from the man in the street. Should he speak to him? Why not walk past and keep walking till the end of the street? He wasn't so naive as to do that. He knew, or had an inkling, that the meeting he had long awaited was about to come, and he didn't want to show any sign of fear or weakness. He was too old for that, and his dignity wouldn't allow him to beg for mercy from his executioner. This is the long wall of two girls' schools, a primary school and a secondary school, said the stranger, whose face was shrouded in darkness. And these are stores and car repair shops, with offices on top that they lock up an hour before sunset. There's no one else on this street right now. A car might come by, or maybe one won't. Do you think I'm frightened, or that I want to call for help? Said the old astrologer, lowering his bag softly onto the surface of the road. He might need both hands while talking to the apparition of the dangerous criminal he had waited to see for so long. That was why he had gone to Lane 7 in Batawin. He didn't know how long the conversation would last, but he wanted to see the man's face before the final moment came. Why had he failed to work out what he looked like? And why was the man now standing in such a position that the distant streetlights did not light up his face? You should know, before you do anything, that this was all planned by my disciple. He failed to kill you that day with a car bomb, and now he's using you to kill me. It's a battle between me and him, and he's using you against me, said the astrologer. Are you saying you saved me that morning? No, I won't lie to you. I wanted to arrest you so I could at least see your face. I wanted to know what you look like. And I want the playing cards you were using to search for me.
and I want those hands of yours as well.
I threw the cards in the trash. I'm not looking for you any longer. I've retired.
Yes. The cards don't matter. What's important are the hands that dealt them.
I'd like to see your face, if I may.
What's the point of that? It changes. I don't have a permanent face.
Let me see.
Yes, said the criminal who has no name, turning on the astrologer and grabbing hold of his hands. He squeezed them tight, and the astrologer felt his strength ebbing away. He fell to his knees, and the criminal kept pushing him down and squeezing his hands.
This isn't your battle. You don't understand. This isn't your battle,
the astrologer said, his voice shaky. Then as he stared straight at the criminal's dark face, the headlights of a distant car lit it up for him. By the light of the car, he finally saw it. Even he, with his cards and magic tricks, hadn't believed he would get to see it. Some voice from his past told him that everything he had lived through was nonsense and lies, and that he was so immersed in these lies that he had come to believe them. This face he had just seen for the first and last time was also from his past. He recognized it. But whose was it? During his slow death throes on the desolate street, he would be wholly convinced that it was a composite face, made up of faces from his distant past. It was the face of his own personal past, which he had thought had no face or features. And now it had appeared to him clearly, caught for a moment in the headlights of a passing car. The driver of the car had seen something suspicious halfway down the street and changed his mind about turning onto it. What he failed to see from a distance was someone taking an axe to the arms of a man laid out on the asphalt. Chapter 18. The Writer. 1. I met Mahmoud Riyad al-Sawadi in the Baghdadi Cafe. The place was crowded with intellectuals, writers, actors, directors, and artists. The long metal benches outside on the sidewalk couldn't fit everyone, especially after sunset, when the scorching summer heat relented. I was sipping my tea when I saw him selling his Rolex and his laptop. He looked as if he hadn't showered or changed his clothes in days. From his pocket he took a small gadget attached to a long silver cord that you could hang around your neck. I figured out that it was a digital recorder. He was talking to his friends about the device, and some of them started laughing. One of his friends pointed to the metal chairs near the table where I was sitting. He came over, and our eyes met. He said it was a Panasonic digital recorder, and that he wanted $400 for it. $100 for the recorder itself, and $300 for the story that was recorded on it. It was the strangest story that had ever come his way, he said, and a writer like me could use it to write a great novel. Even before he spoke, I had made up my mind to buy the recorder, not because I needed it, but as a kind of charity. I was even more resolved when I heard he had large debts and needed to pay them off before going back to his family in Maisan province. But I didn't expect to buy a story or pay $400. I couldn't pay such an amount on short notice. I was curious about him. He wasn't disturbed, someone with psychological problems, or a swindler. He was intelligent and well-spoken. But he was in a difficult position. I felt he deserved help, so I said, I'll pay $300, that's all I can afford. $200 now, and the third $100 I'll have to borrow from the owner of the hotel where I'm staying. But I want it now. I want $400, or else I won't be able to pay the layout woman.
The what woman?
The woman who does the layouts at the magazine. She's still trying to collect her salary. He spoke at length about what had happened at the magazine. The staff had found out he was living at the Dilshat Hotel, and they'd made a scene at reception, demanding their salaries. I paid for the tea and walked with him to a nearby restaurant. I ordered takeout, and we went to the Fanar Hotel on Abu Nuwas Street, where I was staying. Together, we drank 2 glasses of the whiskey I keep in my room and ate our dinner.
Why don't you just skip town? I asked him.
Aren't you going back to my son? Just go. You're not responsible for the problem.
I can't, he said. I feel sorry for them, and I earned masses of money at the magazine. In salary and allowances, I mean. I feel responsible. I don't want them to speak badly of me and put me in the same category as Saidi and his accountant. It was a strange attitude, with a large dose of idealism, but it won my admiration. During dinner, I put on my headphones to listen to a little of what was on the recorder, which Mahmood said amounted to more than 10 hours. I was really excited. I gave him the $400, and we agreed to meet the next day. I wanted to drive him back to his hotel, but he said he could walk. Part of me knew he would never show up again. He played his part well, and in the end extracted the amount that he wanted from me. He fooled me. But don't we always do that? Today he deceived me, and tomorrow I will deceive someone else, also with good intentions, and so on. I was busy writing a novel called The Uncertain and Last Journey, and didn't want to abandon it to pursue the incomplete story told in the recordings. But then one morning I received an email from someone who called himself the second assistant, and who said he knew me through friends we had in common, and that he trusted me, but at the same time didn't want to reveal his identity to me in order to protect both of us. This second assistant sent me numerous documents over several days, saying he thought they should be made public. They were about the activities of a government agency called the Tracking and Pursuit Department. And it was very exciting when I found that the documents referred to aspects of the story that Mahmood had told me. With my bottle of Black Label on the plastic table on the balcony, I sat down and drank slowly and with pleasure. I forgot about my novel and breathed in the smell of the trees that the moist night breeze carried from the river, and listened again through the speaker on the digital recorder to Mahmood al-Sawadi's confessions and the tales of the criminal who has no name. 2. On his first day in detention, Mahmood al-Sawadi was interrogated for many hours. They didn't manage to get much out of him.
"I'm just a member of staff. Saidi pays me a salary," Mahmood said repeatedly,
and they felt like he was telling the truth. They didn't beat him, as he had expected. They didn't harm him in any way. He spent the night with other detainees, and early in the morning he was summoned to sign a statement. They gave him back his wallet, his cell phone, and his other belongings, then took him to the door, saying he must cooperate and inform the authorities of any new information he came across about Saidi. All this was only the first stage of Mahmood's misfortunes. He had lost an excellent job. He had been waiting to be paid at the end of the month so he could settle his debts with the hotel. And now he couldn't take a job as a mere editor at another magazine or newspaper, having become accustomed to the power and influence of being editor-in-chief, not to mention the lifestyle he had grown used to because of Saidi. He had put too much trust in Saidi. Mahmood sold his best clothes and shoes to the second-hand clothes dealers at Bab al-Sharqi and agreed to sell the rest of his stuff to some friends. Before selling his phone to one of his friends, he made 3 last calls. The first was to his elder brother Abdullah, to tell him he would be coming back to Maisan.
"Why are you coming back? Aren't you happy in Baghdad?" asked Abdullah. "No, I miss you. Baghdad's heading for civil war. I'm worried I might die from a car bomb one morning."
"But your work is there. Try to be careful."
"The people who die every day are usually careful," said Mahmood.
"I don't understand, Mahmood. You know your friend is now a senior official in the province. He might remember you and make trouble for you."
"He won't remember me. He's too important now to bother with me. My article's ancient history."
"As you say, brother," said Abdullah. "You know we miss you."
"Good. I'll come back. Don't call me on this phone. I'm about to sell it. When I get home, I'll tell you what happened here."
"Come home safe now."
His second call was to his friend Hazem Aboud, who told him he wouldn't be back in Baghdad until next week. He was busy taking pictures with the U.S. military unit and might email Mahmood some pictures for the magazine.
"What magazine?" said Mahmood. "There is no more magazine. I wanted to see you before I go back to Maisan."
Hazem was taken by surprise. They chatted for 3 minutes. But when it became clear that Mahmood wouldn't get to see his friend, Mahmood looked for another number to call. The number 666 appeared on the screen, and he pressed the call button and put the phone to his ear.
A soft female voice answered, "The number you have dialed is not valid or is out of service. Please." He wanted to hear her voice and see her before he left Baghdad. He didn't believe what Saidi or Sultan had said. They were lying and trying to tarnish her image. He knew he had a chance with her. If he heard her voice now, instead of that automated voice, he would find a good excuse to stay in Baghdad, even if he had to live in the Aruba Hotel again, with its stuffy, humid rooms, and if he had to work at any newspaper or magazine, whatever the pay. She was the only person who could give him hope and make him act a little mad. Madness and hope that he greatly needed right now. He called her number again, and again he got the automated message. He felt very bitter, as if night were descending on him, a night that would never end. He opened the back of his phone and lifted up the battery so he could take out the SIM card. He put the battery back in place and snapped on the back of the phone. Then he went to give the phone to his friend who had bought it. He put the SIM card in his pocket, then took out the digital recorder to try to sell it. Mahmood had told me all the details over 2 days, and I had listened to the recordings on the digital device. I was struck by the fact that the voice on the recordings, attributed to the man Mahmood called Frankenstein, was deep, like that of a well-known broadcaster. I had suspicions that the whole story was made up, but a week later, in one of the wards at the Kindi Hospital, I heard the voice again, when I sat down next to the bed of an old man called Abu Salim. He told me further interesting details relevant to the story of this Frankenstein. I couldn't be absolutely sure the voices belonged to the same person, but the story completely engrossed me, and I started looking for other sources to corroborate it. Mahmood sold all his possessions and paid off the staff of Al-Aqiqa magazine. He packed a small bag, the one he had originally brought with him from Maysan, and settled his account at the Dilshad Hotel. The country was about to succumb to further waves of violence. It made sense to move away, and that's what many of Mahmood's friends would do. Farid Shawaf was going back to his little village near Ishaqi, north of Baghdad. He was going to renounce, at least temporarily, the glory of satellite television and smart suits. Zaid Murshid was going to Hilla. Adnan Al-Anwar would go to Najaf, where his family and uncles lived. Because of his work as a press photographer embedded with U.S. military units, Hazem Aboud wouldn't be able to go back to Baghdad's Sadr City, and he wouldn't find the Aruba Hotel still standing, or Abu Anmar. He would end up sharing a room in another cheap hotel with a photographer friend. 3. Abu Salim left the Kindi Hospital on crutches. His children came to discharge him. They didn't take him to their house on Lane 7, but rather to the house of the husband of one of Abu Salim's daughters, until they could rebuild the front part of the house. The NGOs and archaeological authorities had asked for work to be suspended on filling in the crater that the explosion had left, because of the wall that had appeared in the middle of the pool of water from the burst sewage and drinking water pipes. Some claimed it was part of the wall of Abbasid Baghdad, and was the most important discovery in Islamic archaeology in Baghdad for many decades. Others ventured to speak, rather boldly, about the advantages of terrorism, which had enabled this important discovery. But the Baghdad city authorities ignored all this and took everyone by surprise by filling the large hole with soil. The spokesman for the city authorities said, "We do not take half measures. We're going to preserve these remains for future generations, and they can judge for themselves how to deal with them. If they decide to demolish the whole Batawin district, that's their business. But for now, we have to repave the street." Abu Salim may have left the hospital, but someone else from Lane 7 had to stay rather longer. Hadi the junk dealer. The bandages on his hands and face had been removed, but he wasn't strong enough to get out of bed. He lay there, wondering what had happened to him and to his house, which had probably collapsed and become a real ruin. But was it really his house? By the time he left the hospital, he might find that Faraj, the real estate agent, had leveled it, rebuilt it, and registered it in his name. But first he had to get well. He could sort out his other problems later. That's what Hadi kept telling himself, to calm himself down, although he couldn't bear having to lie down like that all the time, and made desperate attempts to sit up and get out of bed. One evening, needing to pee, he tried to get out of bed once again. The patients nearby were asleep, and the nurses on duty were elsewhere. He heaved himself upright and moved his feet, which were wrapped in bandages. Then he slowly put them down on the floor, touching the cold tiles with the tips of his toes. Within a few minutes, he had managed to stand. He started to move forward, supporting himself against his neighbor's beds. Then he put his hands on the wall and started walking slowly toward the bathroom. Once he got there, he noticed his reflection in the mirror above the sink. The fire had completely disfigured him. He had realized this days earlier, when he came out of the coma and saw the pattern on the skin after the bandages had been removed. But he had expected his face to be in better condition. He was a horrible creature, and even if he made a full recovery, he would never look the same as before. In shock, he wiped his hand along the surface of the mirror to make sure it was really a mirror, and then leaned in to examine his disfigurement. He wanted to cry, but all he could do was stare. As he looked closer, he detected something deeper. This wasn't the face of Hadi the junk dealer. It was the face of someone he had convinced himself was merely a figment of his fertile imagination. It was the face of the what's-its-name. Hadi let out a horrible scream, startling the patient sleeping in the ward. His leg was in a plaster cast, and he slipped on the bathroom tiles and fell backward, banging his head on the edge of the toilet seat and losing consciousness. 4. My face changes all the time, the what's-its-name told the old astrologer that night. Nothing in me lasts long, other than my desire to keep going. I kill in order to keep going. This was his only justification. He didn't want to perish without understanding why he was dying and where he would go after death, so he clung to life, maybe even more than others, more than those who gave him their lives and parts of their bodies, just like that, out of fear. They hadn't fought for their lives, so he deserved life more than they did. Even if they knew they couldn't prevail against him, they should at least have fought back. It wasn't honorable to surrender in battle, and what a battle! It was a battle to defend their lives, the only battle worth fighting in this life. Fear of the what's-its-name continued to spread. In Sadr City, they spoke of him as a Wahhabi, in Adamiya as a Shiite extremist. The Iraqi government described him as an agent of foreign powers, while the spokesman for the U.S. State Department said he was an ingenious man whose aim was to undermine the American project in Iraq. But what project might that be? As far as Brigadier Majid was concerned, the monster itself was their project. It was the Americans who were behind this monster. People in coffee shops spoke of seeing him during the day and vied to describe how horrible he looked. He sits with us in restaurants, goes into clothing stores, or gets on buses with us, they said. He's everywhere and has an amazing speed, jumping from roof to roof and wall to wall in the middle of the night, they added. No one knew who his next victim would be. And despite all the assurances from the government, people grew more convinced with every passing day that he would never die. They were well aware of the stories of bullets passing through him. They knew he didn't bleed, and didn't let anyone catch a glimpse of his face. The definitive image of him was whatever lurked in people's heads, fed by fear and despair. It was an image that had as many forms as there were people to conjure it. Although I had been immersed in this story for a long time, even I started to feel afraid. 5. Brigadier Surur Majid was forced to retire. That was the last I heard. But apparently he didn't take it lying down. He sought a new job through his connections and finally succeeded in getting back into government service. Not in the tracking and pursuit department, which had been disbanded, but in some remote place outside the capital, as just a security officer in the local police headquarters. Yet again, he obtained an exemption from the debathification decrees. I spent many months visiting Batawin to fill in the other parts of the story, I sat in the coffee shop of Aziz the Egyptian, who said he had visited Hadi in the hospital 3 times. The first time, Hadi had been in a coma. The second time, Hadi spoke to him from behind layers of bandages. The third time, the doctors told him that Hadi had left without anyone noticing. I didn't manage to speak to Faraj the realtor. He spent most of his time at home, and one of his sons had taken on the responsibility of running the office. Salim prevented me from meeting her husband again after my interesting first meeting with him at the Kindi Hospital. But I did get in touch with Father Josiah. I visited him in church and heard from him parts of the story of Elishva, her lost son, her daughters in Australia, and Nader Shamuni the deacon. In messages from my son, Mahmoud al-Sawadi gave me the latest on his dealings with Ali Baher al-Saidi, who was on the run from justice. When I saw a picture of Saidi in an old issue of Al-Aqiqah magazine, I remembered I had seen him before, at a conference for intellectuals at the National Theatre some years earlier. He was a brilliant and eloquent man. At the time, I felt hopeful that men like Saidi would break into the political arena rather than leave it to the semi-educated people and illiterates. The second assistant continued to send me emails with documents from the Tracking and Pursuit Department, especially ones related to the inquiries that were still underway. The last document he sent me was about the junior astrologer's confession that he was responsible for killing his superior on a Baghdad street by controlling the criminal who has no name by remote suggestion, and making the criminal cut off the old astrologer's hands to fit them onto his own body. But the junior astrologer strongly denied he was responsible for creating the criminal in the first place. He had succeeded only in exploiting it. He had wanted to eliminate the criminal, but his superior had intervened. That was the essential reason for the disagreement between them. I was anxious as I wrote the story, fearing the door of my hotel room might suddenly open and I would be arrested. In the end, that's what happened. I had an incomplete 17-chapter version of the story in my hands when I was arrested and sent for questioning in front of a panel of Iraqi and American officers. My novel was confiscated, and they asked me many questions. They were polite and pleasant. They gave me water and a cup of tea and allowed me to smoke. They didn't harass me at all. They asked me about the documents I'd received, what I had done with them, and who this second assistant was. If he was the second, that presupposed there was a first, and the two of them must be assistants to someone. Were they my assistants? Was I running some network? What domestic or foreign connections did I have? What were my political convictions? I was thrown into detention for a few days while their experts read the incomplete text of my novel. Then one morning they summoned me. They didn't say much. I found a written pledge on the interrogator's table. They asked me to sign it without reading it. I was worried and wanted to object, but I was afraid they would send me back to the cell. I signed the pledge in silence. They returned my personal belongings, but not my copy of the novel. Apparently, I was not allowed to rewrite it. They set me free without even taking a close look at the identity card I had shown them. It was a fake, one of several I have to make it easier to get past the checkpoints that the warring sectarian militias in Baghdad sometimes set up. The interrogation panel wasn't serious, I thought, as I headed back to the hotel. It seemed like a formality. I sat in front of my computer and resumed writing. I kept at it for several days, until I received another email from the second assistant, the last message I would receive from him. It included a copy of the final report from the Committee of Inquiry. I read it quickly and was terrified. They were moving toward rearresting me. I had a feeling they would treat me differently this time. I hurriedly gathered up my stuff, paid my hotel bill, and escaped to my house. On the way, I remembered my fake identity card. I took it out of my pocket and threw it out the taxi window. I assumed that, as in the case of the Frankenstein they'd been trying to arrest, the people pursuing me would never see me again. Chapter 19. The Criminal. 1. Abdullah burst into his brother Mahmud's room.
"The mantis has been killed," he announced.
Mahmud was half asleep on his bed, resting his eyes from the constant reading he had been doing since coming back to the house in Jedidah and Maisan. He discovered he had many books he had bought but had never read, and others he wanted to reread. And he had had enough of the hustle and bustle of the outside world and needed a period of peace and tranquility. Plus his mother was worried the mantis might carry out the promise he had made about a year earlier to kill Mahmud if he ever came across him in the streets of Amara, and he didn't want to make his mother anxious or cause trouble for anyone. This went on for about 2.5 months. But now his time in preventive detention was over. A group of men had ambushed the mantis on the highway while he was traveling in a motorcade from Wasit province. They fired a hail of bullets, killing him, the driver, and some of his aides before taking flight. Mahmud thought back to his theory about the three kinds of justice, but he wasn't convinced it was valid. It was anarchy out there. There was no logic behind what was happening. He took a deep breath and gave a long sigh. What mattered now was that he had broken free of a worry that had been weighing heavily on him. At last he left the house, with no particular destination in mind. His mother didn't even look up. When he reached the main street, he remembered he hadn't checked his email in ages. He boarded a bus and headed for the market. He ran into some friends who couldn't figure out why he was so cheerful. Then he headed to the internet cafe, where he sat in front of a computer and opened his email. There were 180 messages, most of them junk mail, but he noticed one message from his friend Hazem Aboud. He opened it and found 10 photographs. They'd been taken in various places, in the countryside and in villages, old sites and ancient buildings. In the accompanying note, Hazem explained his situation, that he would probably be able to get a green card because of his work with the U.S. military and wouldn't be able to go back home for fear of assassination by the militias. Mahmud felt Hazem was exaggerating and wanted to justify his long-standing wish to emigrate to the United States. There was an email offering Mahmud a position as Maisan correspondent for a major Baghdad newspaper. Then he found one from a name he didn't recognize. He opened it and was surprised to see it was from Nawal al-Wazir, telling him she had tried to call him several times without success and sending him her new phone numbers. "You must call me Mahmud," she wrote. He wanted to call her immediately, but the next message he opened made him forget everything else. It was from Ali Baher al-Saidi. He had clearly spent much time and effort drafting it. Mahmud found it completely engrossing. 2. Dear Mahmud, how are you? I've called you dozens of times, but it seems your phone is permanently switched off. I've been worried about you, my friend. I've heard from some friends about the interrogation you went through. That hurts me. They are real bastards. I fear they may have deeply distorted the way you see me, and I may not be able to undo the damage, but you are very dear to me. I swear by the life of my mother, who was killed by terrorists in Ramadi on the highway to Jordan, and by the lives of my dear sisters, that I didn't steal a single penny from this lousy government or the American occupiers. It was a conspiracy against me, and now I'm on the run from the broken judicial system. They wanted to drive me out of the country because they knew I had an honest plan for the country, and that the moment of confrontation was coming between the sincere patriots and those who work for foreign interests. They wanted to eat me for lunch before I could eat them for dinner. You're not obliged to believe what I say, but tell me honestly, did I ever lie to you? Didn't I promote you personally to give you the chance you deserved? Did I mistreat you or anyone else? Wasn't I helpful and cooperative with everyone? Think back a little and try to remember. You may wonder why I'm spending this time and effort writing to you, and why I'm so eager to persuade you of my point of view. I'm not interested in all the things that have been said about me, or the smears in the press, or the way they've portrayed me as an international criminal, or the arrest warrant they've asked Interpol to issue. I can deal with those things. I have a strong heart, and I have the energy to fight those bastards. I'll beat them one day, you'll see. But I can't bear the idea that you might think ill of me, especially you.
It matters because I see myself in you. We're very much alike, even if you can't see the resemblance. I think we are similar, and you are someone pure and noble, and what you think of me is more important than anything else. You'll remember Brigadier Majid and the time we went to see him. After lunch, he told me what the senior astrologer working with him had told him. We didn't go there to buy a printing press or to interview him or anything else. I couldn't tell you the truth at the time, in case you got the wrong idea. I preferred to keep it to myself. But now, I feel compelled to disclose it. The visit was for something specific, so his astrologers could tell your future. The future of Mahmud al-Sawadi. And I was really stunned and surprised by what I heard. The senior astrologer said, this young man, meaning you, had a brilliant future. He would rise to become one of the most important people in Iraq, but he needed training. He needed a challenge in order to learn how to handle it. I don't know how you'll take this now, but in precisely 15 years, Mahmud, you will become Prime Minister of Iraq. Yes. You will be Prime Minister Mahmud al-Sawadi. And I, ever since I heard this and believed it, have made you my project, and I have given myself a specific role in this project. I will be John the Baptist, and you will be Christ. I will help the weak sapling become a mighty tree. I shall be back to Baghdad soon, Mahmud. I will disprove all the charges against me, and you will see people go on trial because of the malicious accusations they made against me. I'll get in touch with you from there, so we can start again and work together. Be sure to remember the senior astrologer's prediction, or try to forget it. It makes no difference, because what is inevitable will come true one day. 3. It was a bombshell. It reminded Mahmud of the way Saidi spoke, of how persuasive he was. Mahmud couldn't help having a whole range of feelings toward Saidi, who had given him plenty of help and exposed him to new experiences. He had become more mature and knowledgeable because of him. He was intrigued by the talk of the astrologers and the new explanation that Saidi offered for their visit to the tracking and pursuit department. So Mahmud had been at the center of events when he thought he was on the periphery. Mahmud put his hands on the keyboard, eager to answer Saidi's email. He was on the verge of apologizing for thinking ill of him, but he soon remembered a slew of uncomfortable facts. He remembered how, under interrogation, he had almost to beg to defend himself against the accusation that he had helped to steal $13 million. He thought back to many times Saidi had contradicted himself. Sitting in the internet cafe, he tried to form a clear, reliable picture of Saidi's convictions and principles, but he couldn't. Mahmud tapped lightly on the keys, but he didn't write anything. He was overcome with confusing emotions, and he noticed he was grinding his teeth. After everything Mahmud had been through, Saidi had managed to trick him and win him over to his cause. He had scored a goal yet again.
"Fuck you,"
Mahmud typed quickly in English. He made the words big and red. He was about to press send, but stopped himself. He hesitated for about 10 seconds, then deleted the two words. He combined Saidi's message and Hazem Aboud's into one and sent it to the writer. He signed out of his email account and left the cafe. Later, Mahmud would send the writer another message, explaining why he decided against answering Saidi's email. He went out into the street and kept walking. He lit a cigarette and looked up at the ominous clouds. It was like those days he had spent in Baghdad a year earlier, when he had met Ali Baher al-Saidi, Nawal al-Wazir, and the others. He walked toward the market thinking, what if Saidi was telling the truth? But he sensed it was all fantasies and lies. Saidi was preparing to dump another disaster on the head of gullible Mahmud. But what if 1% of his story were true? Isn't life a blend of things that are plausible and others that are hard to believe? Isn't it possible that Saidi reaching out to Mahmud was one of those hard-to-believe things? That's why Mahmud didn't send a hostile response to Saidi's message, or any other kind of response. He left things in a gray area,
like the sky that day, trying to use Saidi's own style against him, leaving him uncertain. 4. On February 21, 2006, the Supreme Security Commanders in Baghdad announced they had finally arrested the dangerous criminal that official reports called Criminal X, and that the public called the What's-Its-Name, along with many other names. They projected a large picture of him on a big screen and announced his name, Hadi Hassani Idris, a resident of Batawin and commonly known as Hadi al-Attag, the junk dealer. The defendant had confessed to all the crimes he was accused of, including leading a murder gang, dismembering his victims, and planting them in back streets around Baghdad in order to spread alarm and fear. He had planned the explosion at the Sadir Novotel by means of a garbage truck packed with explosives and driven by a suicide bomber who was one of his followers. He had murdered a number of foreign security contractors and was responsible for the horrific explosion in Batawin, which resulted in deaths, destroyed houses, and did inestimable damage to Iraq's architectural heritage. On top of that, the criminal was implicated in acts of sectarian violence and in murders for hire on behalf of gangs and sectarian groups. Aziz the Egyptian saw the picture of his close friend on television and didn't recognize him. That wasn't Hadi the junk dealer. That's what most of the people in the coffee shop said, too. But when they broadcast recordings of the criminal's confessions, the voice was very similar to Hadi's. How could he be a murderer? Seeing Hadi's disfigured face on television while sitting with his family at home, Mahmoud al-Sawadi thought this was just another massive mistake. They wanted to close the case in any way possible. It was inconceivable that this elderly man was a dangerous criminal. He had sat with him for hours. He was just a drunkard with an unstable personal life and a powerful imagination. But his story about the What's-Its-Name still posed many questions for Mahmoud. Hadi was permanently scatterbrained. He didn't have any of the eloquence or composure apparent in the digital recordings of the What's-Its-Name strange long monologues. It was impossible that Hadi was the What's-Its-Name. 5. When people heard the news, the sky over Baghdad crackled with gunfire. Everyone was in a state of hysterical joy, especially in Batawin. Nobody could believe that this frightening criminal had been living among them, but what the government said must be true. Salim came out and danced in the street, rattling her golden bracelets on her white arms. Her husband looked on shyly through the crack in the door, his hands pressed into the pockets of his pajama top. Veronica, the old Armenian woman, came out to throw gum and candy on the heads of the children in the lane, and despite the black clouds that were gathering, people continued to dance in the streets and on the roofs of buildings for more than an hour. They were tasting a kind of joy they had forgotten in the decades of disasters that had befallen the country. Everyone was happy. Even Faraj the realtor, who had been sunk in pessimism and despair since the massive explosion in Lane 7. Aziz saw the spontaneous celebrations, but still wasn't convinced that Hadi was the criminal. It was impossible. But he went to dance outside the coffee shop anyway. Reduced to a state of childlike elation, no one could see, or even tried to see, those timid eyes looking out from behind the balconies and windows of the abandoned Aruba Hotel. Since Faraj had taken down the sign outside, the hotel hadn't had a name. It was no longer the Aruba Hotel, and it hadn't yet become the Grand Prophet Hotel, as Faraj had been planning to call it. He had lost a large part of his fortune on the two properties, one of which had been totally destroyed, the other seriously damaged. To repair it, he would have had to spend a fortune, so he left it as it was, deserted, a ruin. He didn't give it another thought. Cats made their homes there, and young men might use it as a venue for hasty love trysts. Rowdier events might have taken place there, but nobody knew exactly. Abu the cat roamed around the hotel. The specter of an unknown man also lingered there, standing for the past hour at the glassless window of a third-floor room, silently watching the people celebrate, smoking and looking every now and then at the dark clouds overhead. Nabu climbed the stairs, up the carpet that had been ripped long ago. The old cat jumped over the legs of broken chairs,